לשידור ישיר ממחנה רמה בברקשיירס.
כל רמה 102.3 מגישים קיץ באוויר.
רדיו כל רמה 102.3 FM.
Shalom and welcome to another edition of Parsha Talk. I'm Rabbi Elliot Malamed, Highland Park, New Jersey, the Highland Park Conservative Temple Congregation on Shemet. Joining me are my good friends, Rabbi Barry Chesler from Solomon Sheikh Day School of Long Island and Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski, Anshei Chesed in New York City. Friends, we are recording this on day 180. It's already day 181 in Israel, and just to even say the number 180 is a moment that makes us pause. Shisha Chodashim, 6 months. Unbelievable suffering for the hostages. And of course, a different reality now that is part of our experience. And of course, the Israel experience, everything seems to have changed, and we are in the middle of it. If you had a reflection on that, Jeremy, I'm going to turn to you. You got the poster in the background again. And just this, even if it's just thinking about what these people must be going through. You know.
Fighting off despair. I never in my life was I on Twitter before the war began. Never even once. The occasional clip I saw of a football game or something like that. But, my children said, don't do it. And I have not. I've only in very measured ways. But I see some of the most virulent anti-Israel stuff, some of which I believe is pure propaganda and falsehood. Some of it is conveying the seriousness of the suffering in Gaza in very painful ways. And the suffering in Gaza, we're talking on a day after the accidental killing of the food workers. And the guy from World Central Kitchen wrote in the Times today, I know Israel is better than the way this war is being conducted. I am not criticizing. I do not know. I want the hostages home.
Yeah.
I want the suffering to end. And it's just fighting off despair. It's not easy.
Very hard. Barry, you have a former student.
I do, and it's important to hold on to hope. But as Jeremy suggested, it gets harder every day. And, Ellie used the expression, which we use all the time, that we're in the middle of this. We have to hope that we're closer to the end than still in the middle, because this has gone on, I think, far longer than we thought in the early days of October.
Think about, how we have all counted time. And Jeremy held up a calendar before of every day, October the 7th. Maybe you'll show that to our viewers here. Look at that. And that says something so deep, which is that on one hand, time has kind of stood still. On the other hand, we know that things have moved on and moved on in ways that have been quite unpredictable, some predictable, but we really don't know how things, what the trajectories are. And that makes for a very unstable kind of moment here, especially on when things are a little darker over the last few days as they've been. And, I'm just thinking, we are approaching another milestone in the Jewish year, Pesach, in a couple of weeks. This is Shabbat HaChodesh. So this Shabbat, we announce the new month of Nisan, and we read this on this Shabbat, the Parshat HaChodesh, which I hope we'll get a chance to talk about shortly. And that signals a kind of change in mood, and we're all beginning to think about our siddharim and what we're going to do. And you know, I've begun to think about, you know, how are we going to incorporate the experiences at the Seder? And maybe, you know, before Pesach, we'll devote some time to that question. It's a question that's on many minds, and people are publishing material, some of it good, some of it not as good. But there's a lot of thinking about this question as to, you know, how are we going to experience the celebration of the Jewish story and Jewish peoplehood this year? And we will, of course, celebrate. Yeah.
It's a question of, you know, first of all, by the way, after Shemini, we got Tazria and Mitzara, so maybe we can devote some of those Parsha talks to talking about the Haggadah. But, you know, a friend of mine, known to many of our listeners, very famous family, Esther Sperber, she's very active. She's one of the leaders of the Families Forum here in New York. She's our architect here at the shul. She's the daughter of a great Talmid Chacham, Daniel Sperber. She sadly just lost her sister this week, which Nechama to the Sperber family. We talked about before Tani and Esther, you know, she put out, you know, should we devote Tani and Esther to like staying with the hostages? And what we said in the course of our conversation is like, on the one hand, yeah, that feels right. On the other hand, it feels a little bit of a false note to say that, okay, we're going to have a little, you know, a short fast on Tani and Esther, and that's going to somehow connect us in the midst of all the starvation in Gaza. Like, it's almost like a false note to say, if I skip lunch, you know, actually there's like real starvation going on. And I'm thinking about feasting. You know, Pesach is always like one of the best meals of the year, aside from not being able to eat bread. But, you know, you have abundant food, you have abundant wine. And it's a time when we are at the center of a story that is largely about terrible, you know, suffering and malnourishment and famine and hunger.
Not to mention war, and not to mention, of course.
It's a little hard to, I heard somebody say, you know, this year we should have, you know, a very small, no feast and no Arba Kosot. And I don't think that that's right. But somehow it cannot be Pesach in all its glory either.
So, you know what, we should dangle this out for our loyal listeners, to whom we thank, and our viewers, and maybe we will devote some time to thinking about that instead of Parshat Tazria next week. But we're going to do Shemini this week, and Parshat Shemini deals with the ordination rituals, the consecration rituals. It's a moment. It's a beautiful moment here where.
Wait, you were going to say something nice though. All that sadness, you got to.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, I'm going to tee up the announcement of my daughter's engagement. Nava became engaged last week. So Mazel Tov. Jacob Zucker is her fiance. He just got out of Gaza back at the end of February, and we are thrilled for both of them, and. Just a beautiful couple, and
Mazal Tov.
Nachas.
Mazal Tov.
And if you are a fan of Adina Sussman's cookbooks, Nava is working on a new cookbook with the preeminent cook of Israel, chef of Israel, Adina. Anyway, so Shemini, which has something to do with food and something to do with the ordination rituals, the Kohanim they've been sequestered in the Ohel Moed for 7 days. And the name of the Parsha, Shemini, comes from the first words, Vayihi Bayom HaShemini. It's the eighth day. And that itself is significant, that these rituals that we are now going to read about come on the eighth day, which tells us that it's the beginning. This is the beginning of a new phase in Israel's life. The ritual life of Israel is going to be inaugurated on this day. And there's a whole menu of sacrifices and all that. And it's, you know, quite intricate in the symbolic system that is very remote from our religious consciousness. Nevertheless, they're doing this. They're cutting up pieces of animals. They're putting it on the altar. They're putting it into smoke. And let's just talk about the a moment of blessing, the moment of blessing that comes when everything is complete. First, you have Aaron's blessing, which is at the end of chapter 9, verse 22, Vayisa Aaron et Yadav el ha'am vayivarchem. He blesses them by lifting up his hands. Now, does he lift it this way? Does he do it this way? Does he do it this way? I mean, these are all great questions, okay?
In the Bible, lifting hands is a prayer gesture, and we have it only in our life with Birkat HaKohanim still.
Right, but the Birkat HaKohanim is this way, okay? Samu et Shmi, place, and the prayer gesture is this way, okay?
I don't know if that's correct.
Okay, maybe, unless you do this.
That is the origin of the touchdown signal, too, which is that...
Right, of course. Okay. So, you know what I like about... There are two things that I like about this. One is, you know, we weren't convinced that Aaron is a good guy... This is a moment where he's a good guy. He wants to involve the people in this moment, and he offers this blessing, okay? He's functioning in a clerical way here, okay? Then the next verse says that Moses, Vayavo Moshe v'Aaron el Ohel Moed, the two of them go into Ohel Moed, and they come out, Vayavarchu Adam, the two of them bless the people. And this is also nice. Now, there are lots and lots and lots of commentary on this as to why, what, how. And I think it's very confusing. But you know what? I'm going to go with this one, which is, you know, Aaron does it solo for the first one, and then it's a duet on the second one. And a solo is different from a duet. The solo gives you the solo performance, and the duet gives you a lot of texture. And that the blessing itself that the two of them have has this balance, a kind of, you know, back and forth, or this, you know, maybe their voices are different. There's a chord, there's some harmony. Maybe there's, and it's just two personalities. One who in the imagination of the people is quite stern and connected to God. And one who's like the, you know, seems like a good guy. What I wouldn't call Moses the straight man and Aaron like the, But you know what I mean? I think like there are comedy duos and there are solo comedians, okay? It's one thing to see Jerry Seinfeld on the stage, but it's another thing to see the ensemble or to see an Abbott and Costello or to see, you know, we talked about this, like a John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. They play off each other, and the play off of each other gives a certain kind of joy. I talked about, you know, in music, this is true, you know, Jeremy Yitzchak Perlman, he's got such this gift, okay? And the gift is just compounded, or it comes out in a different way when there's someone else there. And the music becomes something just absolutely gorgeous. And so I think what we have here is, at the very least, a gorgeous moment of two brothers who are together in a mission. And they're conveying to the people, we're together in this. We're a team. That's my little drasha.
That's very good drash. I like that drasha a lot. And it's true about comedy. It's true about music. It's both Simon and Garfunkel.
Yes, of course.
But I would also say that, you know, because you brought up the different characters of Moshe and Aaron, there's a passage in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that says, Moshe is Yikov Hadin et Ahar. Let the law pierce the mountain. I don't care. It's his personality is, I'm going to tell you the truth and what's right, and let the chips fall where they may. And Aaron is, this is the famous passage that he said, he's a peacemaker. He's Ohev Shalom, Rodef Shalom. He helps people get together when they've been alienated. He'll even, you know, sand off the edges of the truth to tell a helpful white lie to bring people together. And if we think about those different like spiritual modalities, you cannot live in one or the other. You have to have, you know, Din and Rachamim, and put them together into some sort of balance. So the bracha that would come from Aaron alone is not as good as the bracha that comes from the unity of the two.
Nice, it's completed with each other. Okay, so having built all this up and built this moment of unity and joy and great excitement, the following verse, chapter 10, verse 1, the last verse of chapter 9 is, Vatetze'esh min lifnei Adonai, the fire comes out, okay, from God, meaning it probably comes out from the Kodesh Kodeshim, okay? The fire comes out, Vatetze'esh min lifnei Adonai, Vatochal al hamizbeach, the fire consumes everything that's on the altar, and there's a lot of meat and other parts of animals on the altar. Et ha'ola ve'et ha'chalavim, the burnt offering and the suet offerings. And here the excitement. Vayar kolam vayaronu. The people see and they get excited. They celebrate. Vayplu al pneihem. They fall on their faces. So this is a moment. This is an ecstatic moment. Can you, what is it like to be in a moment of collective ecstasy? Right? I don't go to too many rock concerts, but
oh, baby, I'm going April 15th in Albany. I'm going to the Beit Kodesh HaKodeshim, see Bruce again.
Wow. Okay. So can you tell us, for those of us who don't experience this on a regular basis or don't experience it at all, is there a moment, is this the language we're using for that? I mean, is ecstasy part of it, or are we just simply being ridiculous here? You know, is there, how would you define religious ecstasy in this moment at the Mishkan? How would you, you know, is there anything that comes close to it? You know?
Well, I love going to Bruce Springsteen shows, but I kind of hope that this is better than that. Like, I kind of hope that the revelation of Hashem's presence in the Mishkan.
But I'm glad you said that, because, okay, so
don't tell Springsteen that.
It puts it into perspective, although those are very powerful experiences. Let's just say that you know, the sense of unity and the sense of joy that people have is a very powerful experience, and this is, they fall on their faces. Okay, so nobody's falling on their face at a concert. So there's what I'll interpret falling on, that's, they're just reverent. There's joy and there's reverence. Vayiplu al pneihem is the experience of awe, and it seems to me that every time you have a falling on the face, it's about, you know, I'm overwhelmed by this, and I'm going to gesture awe. Okay.
But it also requires some kind of resolution. In other words, you can't stay on the top. You have to switch metaphors, come down a little bit from the mountain, and okay, that doesn't quite happen here.
All right, so well, something completely awry happens here, which is that there's a catastrophe.
I don't know that it's completely awry. I think that it's unexpected.
Okay.
But on the other hand, it also makes sense, I think, if we depending on how we understand what Nadav and Abihu actually do.
Is it a resolution? So here, let's explain then. They bring
so
in,
what's the called fire Ishtar comes Adonai down, yeah, and the people fall on their faces. And I think they're waiting for something to happen, something to let them know that the moment has passed. Because when you have these peak moments, you need to know that they're over. You don't know that they're over while you're in the midst of them.
Bim Shoch HaYovel, in Exodus, you know, 19 and 20, God comes down to the mountain, says nobody can touch the mountain. And then when the horn is blown, then you know it's over. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's now to normal time again. You know, the ecstatic thing, I mean, I totally think, you know, as per what I said before, like, you need Aaron the peacemaker and Moshe the demanding legalist. You need strength to get through the what's the line in Moby Dick there, the dark, damp November in my soul. That's part of the religious repertoire that you need something to just bear on when life is just ordinary. But part of what you get, well, part of what gets you through that is you've had certain moments where you say, yes, this is just all before me. It's joyful, it's affirmative, and it's unstable. And the you know, ecstatic delight can't be all of life. It has to have sometimes, because that affirms that your path can sometimes really open up things that you've never seen before and never experienced before, and you walk away William James in the Varieties of Religious Experiences, the thing about mystical experience is that people always walk away saying, I know something now about the world that I didn't know before. You have to have those experiences, but they are unstable. And Nadav and Abihu perhaps represent the instability.
So I want to suggest they do something a little bit differently, that rather than coming down off the metaphorical mountain, they want to go back up. So what do? They, the two of the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Abihu, each of them takes their fire pan, their censer, and they put a fire in it, and add some incense, and they bring this fire pan into the Kodesh, the holy, to place it on the Mizbeach HaKetoret, the incense altar that is just before the Parochet, which is the entrance into the Kodesh HaKodeshim. And this is something that God did not command them to do. And I think there are grounds for understanding that Nadav and Avihu wanted to do something extra, not necessarily something that was forbidden, because they were not ready to come off their high. They had reached the peak and they wanted to stay there. And in fact, what ensues is a lesson that you can't. That peak moments are peak moments. They're not peak periods of time.
Right. And so by offering the Esh Zara, the foreign fire, they're either performing something out of their own exuberance, they're stepping outside of a boundary of prescribed ingredients of the sacred incense. They're adding to it. They're doing something that
they want to join their fire, which is the Esh Zara, not God's fire, with God's fire.
Right.
And in fact, what happens? They are burned.
They're burned.
So the fire overwhelms them.
And this is a catastrophe. You know, before, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, the instability of peak moments. You know, and the first thing that came to mind is the Challenger disaster, where you had people standing at the platform, looking at the and with exuberance, they were cheering, and then it exploded. And as it exploded, nobody knew what happened. Of course, people on the ground, the mission control, kind of knew. And then in the understatement of all understatements, it was, Houston, we have a major malfunction, right?
Wow. Yeah, that was Apollo 13, but
oh, wait. Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah. Houston, we have a problem. And sorry, it was Apollo 13. I'm so, oh, yeah. My God. My canonical quotes are Houston, we have
this
a problem.
It's a different canon.
Okay. And then it was for the Challenger, it was, we have a major malfunction. And of course, it was the total destruction of it. And nobody knew in the instant what happened. But that instability was expressed by the awe and the shock of the people, you know, watching. And of course, many of us were watching it on television as it was happening. And of course, saw the replays over and over and over and over again over those few days. And the point is, yeah, it's an unstable moment. And the unstable moment here is resolved in a catastrophic way. Just like, as you said, it was resolved in a catastrophic way at Har Sinai with the golden calf. Okay. And so what ensues then is a very difficult, you know, conversation, dialogue, you know, exchange of words between Moses and Aaron, because Moses sees that there's a crisis, you know, a major malfunction here, but he still wants to complete the act. Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, Hu asher diber Adonai lemor bikrovai akadesh. I don't have my translation in front of me, and these are very difficult words to translate, and so I'm going to cue you up, any one of you who has this.
Okay, so in the older JPS the old new JPS translation, then Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord meant when he said, through those near to me, I show myself holy and gain glory before all the people.
And then it says, Vayidom Aaron, and Aaron kept silent. And so we're you know, even reading that, you got to go like, what are you saying, Moses? What? How can you be saying this? You know, this catastrophe has happened here, and you're worried about, you know, the intricacies of the ritual here. Is that what's going on here? Is he worried about just fulfilling the letter of this? Is he worried that the sanctuary has now been defiled by the presence of the corpses? And Aaron, it's too much for Aaron. And you know, we do, you know, use this text to sometimes articulate just the impossibility of a moment of catastrophe and trying to relate to it. But there's more going on here, obviously.
So I don't often quote Ramban, Nachmanides, but I think his interpretation of Vayidom Aharon rings clearest for me. And he suggests that what Vayidom Aharon means here is not that Aaron was silent, but that he became silent.
He fell silent, yeah.
And that makes a big difference, because we don't want to think that Aaron's reaction was superhuman, on one hand, that in the wake of such terrible news, he is a little anachronistically stoic, but we also don't want to understand that he is struck dumb and incapable of acting at all. And therefore, Ramban suggests that he did act, he reacted, he processed the immediacy of his grief, and then he settled down.
I think, you know, I don't know. It's overwhelming, and maybe he's not processed it yet. He doesn't know what to say.
Maybe yes, maybe no. And here I think it's always important to recognize that we're not hearing this or reading this from Aaron's perspective, right? Whoever we think the narrator is here, it's the narrator that's reporting, not Aaron himself.
Is the narrator making a judgment on him? Is the narrator, you know?
Well, I think the narrator is opening up the possibility for a multiplicity of readings. I think I used to teach this story in 10th grade Bible as Nadav and Avihu, a tragedy in three verses. And each of the verses that we read is subject to more than one interpretation. And here, the question is whether Moses is offering true words of comfort, or in fact is a rebuke of Aaron for holding him responsible for what his sons did. And it's not clear, because Aaron, in fact, doesn't say anything. So how can we know what he thinks?
I wanna, you know, be the Nechama here. I'm troubled by it, and I want to put my arm around him and say, you're a bereaved parent now. And of course, there's nothing you can say.
But this is the episode that happened a little bit later on in the Parsha, in the end of chapter 10. You know, you said, "What is Moses worried about the details of the worship?" You know, I think the answer to that is partly yes, and that's a feature of the let the law pierce the mountain personality. This is conceived of as being very important. Ritual moment, dedicating of the Mishkan, and it turns out that the Chatat. Now, here's you have to know this piece of temple data is that the way a Chatat works, and Olah isn't altogether burned. Nobody human eats it. A Chatat is a sin offering or purification offering. Certain parts, the forbidden fats and these certain organs, are burned on the altar, and the priests eat the rest of the animal. And the priest's consumption of it is like, that's how the atonement or the purification happens. And Moses discovers to his shock that the chatat that was offered was entirely burned up and the priest didn't eat it. So it didn't work. And he says to Aaron, what happened? What did you do that for? And Aaron says to him, after what I've experienced today, do you think it would be pleasing to God for me to eat that sacrifice? In other words, sacrificial worship, even the priests eating the chatat, is in a spirit of joy. It's an experience of communion. And Aaron says to Moses, I'm in no position to have that communion right now. And Moses says, yeah, you're right. My bad. And I think that's a powerful moment, perhaps a way of recognizing that we can be overly focused on procedural things and have to stop and go where you just went, Elliot, and say, Okay, I'm going to shut up now and focus on just being.
Right. So I just want to add one other thing here. So in the aftermath of the story, in the first three verses, Moses tells a couple of the cousins to retrieve the bodies. And then he instructs Aaron and Eleazar and Itamar, the surviving sons, that they're not allowed to mourn because, in fact, they are the high priests who are not allowed to mourn in the sanctuary. And Aaron, to that, says nothing. And then there's the instruction about not consuming alcohol. And then we end up with the story that Aaron related. And I would suggest that as Jeremy related this story, Aaron's words suggest that he has understood what happened. And the important point that I think he's making is that Moses can only see this as a national tragedy. What will befall the people when Aaron is telling him this is a family matter?
It's a personal.
Beautiful.
And you can't trump the family with the people. The family's mourning must take precedence.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock, and I know we're heading out of time, but we got to devote a couple of words to Achodesh, because at least this is the death of Nadav and Abihu and the catastrophe that happens is a very serious topic, and of course it takes us in different places. But let's take a few seconds, minutes maybe, to talk about Achodesh, which let's start off with the word family. That Achodesh, chapter 12 of the book of Exodus, is now the first commandment is the first set of instructions for preparing the Passover offering in the family home. And I always like to point out that, that this is about everybody. V'ichulahem ish se levet avot se labayit. Chapter 12, verse 3 in the book of Exodus. Everybody's supposed to take a sheep for their household, se labayit. And that underscores the whole idea that this experience is now happening in the family's circumstances. But I mean, give me 2 seconds on this, off the top of your heads. What do you want to tell our viewers, listeners about this chapter and what you want them to take away from this? I'll say celebite, okay? And how about another?
But what do you say about celebite?
I would say that you organize the people on the basis of the family structure, and that the narrative of the people, which is what is going to happen here, happens from family. I've been teaching over the last couple of days from this guy named Marshall Duke. He's a psychologist at Emory University. I remember his name because his first name is a store and his last name is a university. Okay. So, and he talks about the importance of narratives and how family stories help children in their lives, right? And if you're a family that tells stories, you develop a certain multi-generational identity. And that's what's going on here, that we have a setting for storytelling. We have a setting for experience. And we have a setting for translating something that's larger than us to us.
I'm going to go with blood on the doorposts. Not entirely dissimilar to what you're saying, that the bonding, if you smear the blood on the doorpost, and this is a great rabbinic midrash, b'damayich chayida, the word blood is a plural word in Hebrew. And there's this scene in Ezekiel, and it's in the classical Haggadah. We say it at Brit Milah. Live in your bloods, plural, and the classic Midrash is Dam Pesach v'dam Brit, okay? Yeah. The blood of the Paschal, the blood of the communal meal, the covenantal meal, and the covenant of circumcision. And it's a religion that we have that is it's full of ideas, and it's full of abstractions and values, and I love abstractions and values. And it's flesh and blood too.
It's really you got it. And there's something that's happening in that moment when they do put the blood on the doorpost. It's protection, but it's also consecration. There's
a little painting as well. I think I would build on what both of you said, because both the ritual of Pesach and the ritual of Milah were, properly speaking, home rituals. That the personal identity, which is how the individual baby boy becomes part of the people, and the national identity, which is how the family identifies itself as Israelite, took place in the home. I think that in 2024, when we observe the Jewish community as a whole, we see that most people, whatever their level of observance, will do something on the Monday night of the first Seder in their home or in the home of someone that means something a great deal to them. And the whole temple ritual that goes with Pesach kind of has been replaced by the Seder and the telling of the story of in the Haggadah. And I find that so instructive because for the rabbis, the temple loomed large in their imagination. And as we know, most of Mishnah Pesachim is about the temple sacrifice. But in the lived memory of the people, Pesach has to be at home. And even if you go away to a hotel, you're eating at your own table with your friends and family. You're not eating, generally speaking, in a large hall of strangers. And, you know, I think it was Tip O'Neill said politics is personal. Well, so is religion. And the way that we create the personal element is by identifying ourselves as people of the covenant and people of belonging to those whom God passed over in Egypt. And so the blood is striking because blood is so precious. We recognize that. And it's precious when it's spilled, but it's also precious when it runs through our veins and arteries and sustains us and the ones we love.
Blood is the life. Blood is the dam hua nefesh.
Even saying the word home gives us a feeling. You know, if we have that a kind of positive relationship to home, it ought to give us comfort. And I think that's a good place to bring a bow on the conversation of Shmini and Chodesh, that we have a moment of catastrophe, but we have also we're touching important themes here. And we want to leave the people with us, viewers, listeners, with comfort in complicated days during complicated time. The Torah is a source of comfort, and the Torah will, you know, that as we begin to think about our experience of Passover this year, let it bring comfort. Let it bring comfort to each individual family, and let it bring comfort to the family of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people. And we hope to be able to discuss some of these themes and how to make our Passovers meaningful this year in a future, maybe even next week. The next edition of Parsha Dak. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Shabbat Shalom.
Radio Kol Rama 102.3 FM.